This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There aren't many jazz singers who really have a feel for songs from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Catherine Russell does, and maybe that has something to do with being the daughter of Louis Russell, a pianist and composer who worked as Louis Armstrong's music director in most of the 1930s and early 40s. Although Catherine Russell is now in her 50s, it's only recently that she started recording early jazz and pop songs, songs associated with such singers as Louis Armstrong, Bessie Smith, Fats Waller, Hoagy Carmichael, Lena Horne, and Frank Sinatra. For a long time, she was a backup singer for such performers as Paul Simon, David Bowie, Cyndi Lauper, and the band Steely Dan. We're going to hear the interview I recorded with her in 2008, after the release of her album Sentimental Streak. Let's start with a track from her new CD, Inside This Heart of Mine. This is As Long as I Live, written by Harold Arlen and Ted Kohler.
Maybe I can't live to love you as long as I want to. Life isn't long enough, baby, but I can love you as long as I live. Yeah, maybe I can't give you diamonds and things like I want to, but I can promise you, baby, I'm gonna want you as long as I live. Well, I never cared, but now I'm scared I won't live long enough. That's why I wear my rubbers when it rains and eat an apple every day, then see the doctor anyway. What if I can't live to love you as long as I want to? Long as I promise you, baby, I'm gonna love you as long as I live.
Music from Catherine Russell's new CD, Inside This Heart of Mine. I asked her what it was like growing up with a father who had been Louis Armstrong's music director. I know your father died when you were seven, so you didn't.
Yes.
You didn't know him as you matured, but did you grow up with a lot of early jazz recordings? Because you certainly have a feel for early jazz on your own recordings.
Well, his recordings were some of the first recordings I remember hearing in my life. You know, so that element of swing and fun was some of the earliest music that I absorbed, you know, and I thought, wow, that sounds like fun. And New Call of the Freaks, one of his hits, you know, for Louis Russell Orchestra, was one of the first things I remember hearing. And I thought, that's funny. And every time I heard it, I would laugh, you know. So I just love the swing of music and when people went out to socialize and dance to swing music. So that's really why I'm drawn to that period of jazz.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Call of the Freaks, because that's one of your father's better known tunes.
Yes.
And your father did two songs that are similar. There's Call of the Freaks and then there's New Call of the Freaks.
Right.
Let's
right.
play one of them. Which would you like us to play?
I would say New Call of the Freaks, because that one has the vocal trio arrangement and the lyrics, take out the can, here comes the garbage man, which I thought was so funny when I was a kid.
Okay, so this is Louis Russell, Catherine Russell's father, and his band. It's New Call of the Freaks, featuring my guest Catherine Russell's father, Louis Russell, who had his own band in the 20s and 30s and then became music director for Louis Armstrong. And while we're giving a shout-out to your father and his musical influence on you, we should also mention that your mother, Carlene Ray, is a musician and singer. Is it guitar or bass or both?
Well, it's both, actually. She was a member of the International Sweethearts of Rhythm in the mid-40s during the Second World War, when a lot of female musicians came to the forefront as a result of the men, you know, going to war. So a lot of female musicians emerged at that time, and she joined the Sweethearts, I think, right after she graduated from Juilliard School of Music in 1946. And she was the band guitarist and then featured vocalist at some points.
And the International Sweethearts of Rhythm was an all women's band.
All female orchestra, yes. All female jazz orchestra.
And just another question about your mother.
Yes.
Did she tell you interesting things about what it was like in the 40s to be a female jazz musician?
Yeah, there were a lot of stories, you know, which formed who she is. And just, you know, she was playing guitar in the 40s and then switched to bass mainly in the 50s. And you know how people would just laugh when she'd walk in, you know, saying, "Oh, little girl, you know, what are you doing with that big instrument," you know, type of thing. And, you know, people really did not take women seriously, and particularly, you know, African-American women. And, you know, she would tell me stories about how there was one night where the black and white started to mix. They were playing some kind of a dance function, and they created a bomb scare because they didn't want the races to be mixing on the dance floor. They'd have ropes down the middle of the dance floor so that black and white couldn't mix, you know, all kinds of different things like that. So, you know, I really feel that the women that came up in that period of jazz were strong beyond our imagination. They really were.
So, you know, you sing a lot of jazz and blues. We talked about the influence of your father, Louis Russell, who started leading his band in the 1920s. What was the music of your contemporaries, your friends, when you were growing up?
Mostly, I'd say the first, you know, I started collecting 45 recordings when I was, 7 or 8 years old. So the first 45 I think I bought was by the Supremes, and I was really into Motown because that's what was, you know, playing on popular radio at that time, and then later on rock and roll, you know, all of the Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, Led Zeppelin, you know, variety of classic rock, and then actually soul music, so Sam Cooke, Otis Redding, Joe Tex, all of those artists.
Now, you had said that one of your influences when you were coming of age was soul music and Sam Cooke. So I thought we'd go to your first CD and listen to you doing a Sam Cooke song.
Okay, excellent.
And we're going to hear Put Me Down Easy.
Yes.
From your first CD, which is called Cat, which is short for Catherine, and my guest is,
yes,
Catherine Russell. You want to say anything about this selection before we hear it?
Sam Cooke also produced so many artists, and those productions, those tunes are great too, you know, the ones that he's not singing. So this is one sung by his brother, L.C. Cooke, and it just struck me when I heard it, and I said, I just have to sing this song.
Okay, and here's Catherine Russell from her first CD, which is called Cat. Catherine Russell from her first CD, Cat, singing a song written by Sam Cooke. let's talk a little bit more about how what life was like for you as a backup singer. I mean, among the people who you sang with were Al Green, David Bowie, Isaac Hayes, yes?
Yes, yes. Al Green and Isaac Hayes were TV shows, so I've also gotten to do a lot of shows with you know, late-night shows with those artists, so I got to sing with Al Green twice.
Tell me something about singing with Al Green.
I was in a section of three women, and we sang I'm Still in Love with You. So,
And what was the part like? What's the part that you were doing?
Let's see. Who, you know, some oohs and ahs, and don't you know I'm still in, sure enough in love with you, you know. And so the three of us were harmonizing behind him, and, you know, in the clip that I taped from the show, I'm just grinning from ear to ear. I'm just so happy and I'm laughing, you know. And so, you know, you can just see me on camera laughing, basically, between phrases.
Okay, let's try another. Touring with David Bowie. What did you have to do?
Well, I got that gig because David was looking for someone that could sing backup parts, you know, backup vocals, and play keyboard parts, which I can do. I did that with Cyndi Lauper. And so it turned out, though, that David let me do everything that I can do, which is play mandolin. I played guitars. I played percussion. And I was really integrated. It's a real band situation with him. So, you know, he's a member of the band. He just happens to be the front person who wrote all these amazing songs, you know. But it's a very integrated situation. So it was a fabulously busy gig for me. So on every song, I was doing something else. String arrangements, you know, that I had learned. And it was just the most incredible musical experience for me, you know, to be singing Ziggy Stardust with him and playing, you know, power chords on an electric guitar. That was fantastic.
What were your lines?
Well, it was kind of, so where were the spiders while the fly tried to, you know, and so it's all of those parts of the song. And also, oh, come on, come on, we really got a good thing going. Come on, come on, if you want it, then you better get on to yourself, you know. And that was another song from the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust that I just love.
So what do you do on stage when you're a backup singer during the parts when you're not singing?
Well, if I'm not playing an instrument, I'm either in a section with other women moving together, so we make sure that, you know, we're moving right and then we're moving left so the section looks coordinated. And if I'm playing an instrument, I'm just doing that and being animated. You know, you
right.
can't really, yeah, you have to be animated. You can't really, you know, stand still and look bored and all that type of thing. You really must reflect that you're happy to be there, you know. So, you know, which is, I think, something that horn players could do more of.
Instead of walking out and having a smoke while somebody else solos or something.
Instead of waiting, yes. Yeah. It would be, you know, nice to see some animation. But that's my personal opinion.
One of the things you did, this is before you started recording under your own name, is that You sang between acts at the comedy club Catch a Rising Star. That strikes me
yes.
like it might have been a real thankless job. How was it?
You know, it was my first kind of real steady gig in New York. And the drummer at that point, they had a trio there who used to play the comics on and off. And the drummer called me up because I had been doing a few other gigs with him. And he said, you know, why don't you come by? You know, maybe I think they would like you here. Come by and sing some blues, you know. So I was scared to death, went the first night, and was there for 4 years. And actually, it was a great gig. And, you know, it really toughens up your character because they put me in the spot, which was called the check spot, which meant that that was the spot in the evening where they would be handing out the checks. So I could sing louder than the people haggling over what they were going to leave, their wait staff and so forth, you know. And they would also put me on after big names, like if they had Eddie Murphy or Robin Williams or somebody else come in of note, Jerry Seinfeld, all these people, Rodney Dangerfield, all these people would come in there. and try out their new acts and so forth. And so they'd always put the singer on after the stars because other comedians, of course, didn't want to follow those people. So it was really good, you know. It was a good training. I did it 6 nights a week for 4 years.
But to sum up, you got the two worst spots. The spot when the waiters were handing out the checks. And after an act that was too tough for anyone else to follow. And was this also the sexist comic era?
It's interesting. I'm not sure about that because, you know, also people like Joy Behar, Susie Essman. So they were there and they were emceeing just as much as, you know, everybody was really there every night. So we were all hanging out together, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel that.
Well, I want to play another song that was written by your father, Louis Russell.
Yes.
And this is I've Got That Thing. It's really delightful. Say something about why you chose this song.
I was looking through one of his early compilations, I think it was the 1929 to 1930 compilation of Louis Russell Orchestra. And I came upon this, and it was kind of another Call of the Freak situation where I thought, this is funny, this is hilarious, you know. And the track was funny, and I started laughing immediately. And I thought, wow, let's recreate this and have, you know, Howard Johnson, you know, come in on some tuba. And it just turned out so great because Stephen, you know, came in and played like this Dixieland, you know, made this Dixieland arrangement of it. So,
and this is Stephen Bernstein who did the arrangements on.
Yes, yes.
On so this is Catherine Russell from Sentimental Streak, a song written by her father called I've Got That Thing.
I don't care if the sun don't shine because I've got that thing.
That's Catherine Russell from Sentimental Streak, and her father, Louis Russell, co-wrote the song we just heard. You taught voice for a few years. Was there any particular piece of advice you would give your students that really came from your experience that you think, like, not all teachers would impart?
The way I teach, I mean, I really stress enjoyment of, you know, performance. Also, picking material that you can express yourself through. Don't pick something that, you know, just because we love Aretha Franklin, we all love Aretha Franklin, you know, but maybe that's not the person that you should be picking. You know what I'm saying? So I love Chaka Khan as a vocalist. She's fabulous, but this is not my particular style. So I would say it's very difficult for singers to find their own style. So you really need to find songs that you can express yourself through, you know, more so than hearing another artist and saying, oh, I want to sound like them.
Catherine Russell, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry. I appreciate it.
Catherine Russell recorded in 2008. She has a new CD called Inside This Heart of Mine. You can hear 3 tracks from it on nprmusic.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Strutting with some barbecue, feeling grand, like all those people down in Dixieland. Oh, listen, listen to the band. Well, I'd like to hear them play while I'm picking on a juicy rib. Oh, baby, strutting, ain't it grand? Give me another helping of that Dixieland. Hey, waiter, please, another rib or two. We'll go strutting, strutting with some barbecue.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stephen Foster was perhaps the first full-time professional songwriter. He made a living on sheet music sales. This was back in the infancy of pop music in the 19th century, before the days of records and radio. Foster's role as one of the fathers of pop music is one reason why rock critic Ken Emerson wrote a biography of Stephen Foster back in 1997. Now he's collected Foster's lyrics in the new book Stephen Foster and Company. It includes Foster's most popular songs like Oh Susanna, Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair, My Old Kentucky Home, Way Down Upon the Suwannee River, and Beautiful Dreamer, as well as more obscure songs. As we'll hear, Emerson is fascinated by the complicated racial meaning of Foster's songs. Some of his songs are written in black dialect for blackface minstrels and are now considered embarrassments, like Masses in the Cold, Cold Ground and Old Black Joe. I spoke with Emerson when his biography of Foster, Duda, was published. He wanted to start with a recording of Foster's song Old Folks at Home, performed by Louis Armstrong and the Mills Brothers. Here's why.
It's particularly interesting because obviously Louis Armstrong did not want to sing this song. And as you hear it, after a brilliant trumpet solo, you'll hear increasingly caustic comments in his inimitable voice. And it shows some of the ways in which Stephen Foster's music to this day is a source of racial embarrassment and infuriation. At the same time, the Mills Brothers are singing this in a very straightforward way. They have no problems with the material, and indeed it's very sentimental and nostalgic. And they do not trip over the word darky, which obviously is no longer a word that any of us would care to use. It doesn't have given them any offense. The double nature of this song shows the sort of divided legacy of Stephen Foster, who after all wrote the most famous songs of the 19th century that's written by an American that still in many ways define American culture. And we have this dual, double divided feeling about the music that is exemplified in this recording.
Well, let's hear it. Louis Armstrong and the Mills Brothers.
On the Suwannee River, far, far away, far away. There's where my heart is turning ever, there's where the old folks stay. All up and down the old creation, sadly our own. Still longing for the old plantation and for the old folks at home. All the world am sad and dreary, everywhere I roam. Oh, dark is how my heart grows weary, far from the old folks at home.
Now, brothers, it was way down upon the Suwannee River.
Far, far away.
Mm-hmm. There's where my heart is turning pepper.
There's where the old folks stay.
Yowza, all up and down the whole creation.
Sadly, he rose.
The one thing, my heart am still longing for the old plantation.
And for the old folks at home.
Now sing, brothers.
All the world.
Hallelujah, hallelujah.
Everywhere I roam.
Yeah, man. Oh, dark is how my heart grows weary.
Far from the old.
Well, look here. We are far away from home. Yeah, man.
Well, Stephen Foster certainly had a very complicated relationship to African Americans and African American music. And, I mean, on the surface, boy, what a really hateful song the lyrics are, you know, sung from the point of view of an African-American yearning to be back on that old plantation. On the other hand, as you point out in your book, Stephen Foster really drew a lot from black music and was inspired by black music. So at one time, his music both condescends to and is inspired by African-Americans.
It sounds like rock and roll today, doesn't it?
It was rock and roll, you say, that connected you to Stephen Foster.
Well,
hard as that may be to believe.
Well, I began my checkered career as a rock critic, and I was always fascinated from the very beginning. When did the impulse among white teenagers to imitate blacks first begin? Obviously, from Elvis Presley to Beck, that has been an important part of rock and roll, but clearly it didn't begin with Elvis Presley. And I sort of pressed it back and thought and listened and learned more and more about the swing era and the Benny Goodmans and the other nice boys from the Jewish Projects of Chicago who fell in love with swing. And going back to the turn of the century and songwriters such as George Gershwin and Irving Berlin, who were deeply influenced by African-American music and emulated it, not only in operas like Porgy and Bess, but in Irving Berlin's first hit song, Alexander's Ragtime Band, which caused him to be mislabeled the King of Ragtime, when obviously Scott Joplin deserved that title. But it goes further back to minstrelsy and blackface back in the 1830s and 1840s and to Stephen Foster and this weird form of American popular entertainment, the first original American form of entertainment, and that's the minstrel show.
The whole blackface era is both a disturbing and fascinating part of American pop music history. What explanations have you been able to come up with for why white people performed in blackface and why that became so popular in the 1800s?
Well, among other things, African Americans represented, in a cruel paradox to many whites and still do, a certain kind of freedom, freedom from bourgeois expectations, freedom from the regimentation of conventional middle-class life. But what many whites don't realize, and indeed sometimes African-Americans don't realize, is that that alleged freedom is the result of oppression and exclusion. So that we always have this, or I shouldn't say we, but at the root of both the rock and roll experience and of the minstrel experience, which was its predecessor, is this tangled, conflicted feeling of the expressing both an oppression and an affection and an admiration simultaneously.
Let's play another one of his famous songs from the Southern tradition he had no part of because he grew up in the Pittsburgh area. This is a song called Old Kentucky Home, one of his really well-known songs. Tell us about how he wrote this song.
Yeah, well, this is a song that is very controversial to this day. It is the state song of Kentucky, and we're going to play a version of it, which is performed nightly during the summer at the Outdoor Sound and Light Theater extravaganza that is held in Bardstown, Kentucky, at my old Kentucky home, State Park. And the song, as we listen to it for a while, you'll see sort of epitomizes the South of cavaliers and crinolines, and yet, ironically, it was actually inspired by Uncle Tom's Cabin, a deeply abolitionist novel, and the sense of loss here, and the sense is because Uncle Tom is being sold down the river, as he was in the famous novel. So we have here again, as in the earlier recording by Louis Armstrong, this sort of dual nature. As a matter of fact, recently, several members of the African-American members of the Yale Glee Club were scheduled to perform this song as part of a celebration, a concert celebrating Charles Ives in the context of his music. They refused to sing it. A copy of the song was burned at a meeting by members of the Glee Club, and indeed another song was substituted. And yet, ironically, here was a song that was inspired by a great abolitionist novel and which no less a leader than Frederick Douglass himself singled out as a song that awakens the sympathies for the slave in which anti-slavery principles take root and flourish. So, like all of Foster's music, it's thick with contradictions that to this day, I think, are part of the American experience.
Let's hear the version you've brought of My Old Kentucky Home.
The sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home. 'Tis summer, the children are gay. The corn tops ripe and the meadows in the bloom, while the birds make music all the day. The young folks
heard Old Kentucky Home and Old Folks at Home. You know, you wonder, what was Stephen Foster's attitude about slavery? He wrote these songs while there still was slavery in the United States.
He certainly did. He was, by inclination and by family, he was a Democrat. He was he was actually related by marriage to James Buchanan, who was the president before Abraham Lincoln, who was trying to hold together the Union at any cost and would make any deal necessary to keep the South in. Foster was, by inclination, what you would, was then called a doughface Democrat. He was certainly not an abolitionist. And this, again, is not unlike the contradictions that many Americans feel. On the one hand, his politics were definitely not abolitionist, but his heart and his feelings were very strongly sympathetic with the African American plight. This contradiction, I think, is the conflict between sentimentality and self-interest is something that I think has always characterized Americans.
You've brought a version with you of Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair. Who did you bring singing it, and what do you think of this recording?
Yeah, I think this is a very an excellent recording. It's by the operatic baritone Thomas Hampson, who has come out a couple of years ago with a CD of Foster songs and has become a good friend and co-conspirator of mine. I think what may interest people with this is that it was originally I Dream of Jenny with the Light Brown Hair. Jenny was the nickname of Stephen Foster's wife, to whom he had, with whom he had an unhappy on-again marriage. And he wrote this when they were estranged, or had, it's a little bit unclear, or possibly just gotten back together again. And he wrote it when he was living in Hoboken, New Jersey, where he set up for about a year.
Okay, well, let's hear Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair.
I dream of Jeannie with a light brown hair, born like a vapor on the summer air. I see her tripping where the bright streams play, happy as the daisies that dance on her way. Many were the wild notes her merry voice would pour, many were the blithe birds that warbled. Song.
and Emerson, you know, I think that song is an example of a song that I think people of my generation were born knowing. You didn't necessarily like the song, but you knew the song. I don't know how you knew it, whether it's because your parents sang it or it was just in the air, but you knew it, even though it was not of your time. Why do you think songs like Jeannie have endured the way they have?
I think that Stephen Foster really did create popular music as we still recognize it today. He did it because he took together all these strands of the American experience. That song is extremely Irish in its origins, just as other songs are extremely African-American, just as others are extremely Italian and operatic, or sometimes German, and even Czechoslovakian. For instance, the beat of O Susanna is the beat of a polka. He clearly, effectively merged them into a single music. And I think he merged them in a way that appeals to the multicultural, mongrel experience of America in its history and culture.
I know when I told a few people here that we were going to be talking to you about your Stephen Foster biography, I got a couple of real eye rolls like, "Huh, Stephen Foster, what are they kidding?" I can imagine the reaction you got from friends in the rock world when you told them your book was going to be about Stephen Foster.
Yeah, they thought I was taking leave of my senses. you know, it's hardly, I mean, but on the other hand, I think that we all have an interest. And I know that, I mean, Greil Marcus talked to me about this a little bit when I undertook this. And the way that Greil and other serious students of rock and roll, Bob Christgau would be another example, all of us have been very interested in its origins and its roots.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the way that we were taught that rock and roll didn't exist until the 1950s, when suddenly in the person of Elvis Presley, rock, the blues and country music joined together, that just didn't work. The racial mixture and complexity of our music just goes back far longer.
You've brought with you a record that I think will successfully bring together your interest in rock music and your interest in Stephen Foster. Do you want to introduce this for us?
Yes, well, this is a song that actually was not a great hit during his time, but in the last decade, it's been his most frequently recorded song. One reason I'm sure is because it's neither as saccharine as A Beautiful Dreamer or I Dream of Jeannie. On the other hand, it does not have blackface lyrics that are an embarrassment and an offense to today's ears. And that's the hard times. Come Again No More, which has been recorded recently by Emmylou Harris, by Bob Dylan. Thomas Hampson is recorded at the McGarrigle Sisters, and I know that my favorite version is the least known of them all, and that's by a singer named Sid Straw. And this is a beautiful arrangement by Van Dyke Parks. And this song, I think, became popular in the very late 80s when there was a momentary recession at the end of Bush's term, the recession that resulted in Bill Clinton's election. And it struck an economic nerve that I think is still touchy in our insecure society today, where even if the stock market is booming, we're all being downsized. So this is Hard Times Come Again No More by Sid Straw.
And before we hear it, let me say to you, Ken, thank you very much for talking with us about your biography of Stephen Foster. And that biography is called Doodah, the author Ken Emerson. Here's its
Thank you very much.
Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears while we also sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever.
Ken Emerson edited and annotated the new book, Stephen Foster and Company, Lyrics of America's First Great Popular Songs. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our interview was recorded in 1997, after the publication of Emerson's biography of Stephen Foster, Doodah. There's a new art world documentary called Exit Through the Gift Shop about street artists and the ways in which their renegade work has ended up selling for lots and lots of money. The credited director is the renowned English street artist who calls himself Banksy and whose identity is a matter of much conjecture. So is much else about this movie. Critic David Edelstein has a review.
Okay, this is complicated. The documentary Exit Through the Gift Shop is billed as directed by Banksy, B-A-N-K-S-Y, which is the pseudonym for an incognito British street artist who's been widely denounced, but even more widely celebrated. But the original director, we're told, was a Frenchman living in L.A. named Terry Guetta, who set out to film guerrilla street artists around the world, including the most elusive of them all, Banksy. At some point, Banksy took over the camera, and Terry became the subject. How that flip-flop happened and what happened next is the story of the film. And it's a wonderful, often hilarious film, even if doubts about its authenticity linger. The acid narration is by Welsh actor Rhys Ifans, who explains how unemployed sad sack Terry became obsessed with videotaping street artists at their clandestine illegal labors. Among those artists were Terry's cousin, Space Invader, known for affixing Space Invader video game images to walls and bridges, Shepard Fairey, who'd break through to the mainstream with his Obama posters, and finally, Banksy himself. Banksy appears on camera, sort of. He's in silhouette, under a hoodie, his voice distorted. After he explains why Terry's videotaping is important, Terry himself speaks.
Most normal art is built to last, like, hundreds of years. It's cast in bronze or it's oil on canvas, but street art has a short lifespan, so it needed documenting. You know, we all needed someone who knew how to use a camera.
I wanted to make a movie about street art. So I wanted to get as much people as possible. He was like more than any drugs to anybody. He was obsession.
Like other New Yorkers, I lived for more than a decade staring at buildings and subways covered with eyesore graffiti. So my view of so-called street art is relativist. If it's good, it justifies the vandalism. If it isn't, throw him in jail. But there's no doubt about Banksy's art. As shown in Terry's footage, his satirical assaults on politics, culture, and capitalism in settings as various as the alleyways of London, the barrier wall in the West Bank, and the rides of Disneyland are provocations of genius. He became the director of this film, he says, when Terry took more than 1,000 hours of tapes and edited them into a hash, a barrage of images with no connective tissue, or as Banksy puts it, the work of someone with mental problems, an unimaginable nightmare. Banksy decided to have a shot at that same raw footage. To get Terry out of his hair, he told the Frenchman to go back home to L.A. and try making his own street art. This leads to the documentary's final section, in which Terry adopts the ridiculous nom de plume Mr. Brainwash and attempts to conquer L.A. with a massive Mr. Brainwash exhibition of paintings and sculptures in the mode of street art, which by then had become a hot commodity. In the last part, Terry transforms into a classic fool, both pretentious and empty, a cross between Peter Sellers' Inspector Clouseau and his Chance the Gardener from Being There. Where Warhol gave us a Campbell's soup can, Mr. Brainwash gives us a Campbell's soup spray can. Elvis Presley holds a Fisher-Price toy gun. Marilyn Monroe's Warholian silhouette is merged with Barack Obama's. The work is derivative of the derivative, which makes it irresistible to many would-be L.A. art world hipsters who turn out in droves. Some reporters have speculated that Terry is a fictional creation, an actor in an elaborate Banksy prank that began years ago to expose the faddishness and philistinism of the art world, and that now reaches its climax with Exit Through the Gift Shop. it's very possible. But if I and other enthusiasts have been gulled, I don't mind too much. An early skeptic, New York Times writer Milena Rysik, hasn't gotten to the bottom of it yet, but makes the case for why the film's reality is, in one sense, moot. She writes that the film, quote, certainly asks real questions about the value of authenticity, financially and aesthetically, about what it means to be a superstar in a subculture built on shunning the mainstream, about how sensibly that culture judges and monetizes talent, unquote. If Banksy had to manufacture Mr. Brainwash to drive home his points, the satire is too rich to make me cry foul. As far as I'm concerned, he can vandalize our movie screens anytime.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air.